You're listening to an Iconic exclusive, which is an interview that we do with one of the industry designers or participators with 13th Age. Due to the nature of the interview, this podcast may run a little bit longer than our normal episodes, as we're just going to let the person we're interviewing talk and answer our questions, and we're going to have a good time doing it. So just be warned, this one may run longer than what you're normally used to listening to.
This is Iconic with your hosts JM, Mark, and Nick. Iconic exclusive.
Welcome to Iconic, where we talk about all things 13th Age. I'm your host, JM, and with me as always is Nick.
Hey.
This week we have a great show for you. We have an interview with 13th Age co-creator Jonathan Tweet. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks.
For those of you who don't know, Jonathan has had his hands in many, many role-playing pies over the years and has done writing outside of the industry as well. Jonathan, welcome. Let's just jump right into the interview. How did you get into role-playing games originally?
So back in 1977, my father introduced me to Dungeons and Dragons. He was a professor at a little college in Illinois, and my hometown was actually sort of an early hotbed of gaming. There was a lot of gaming activity there even that early, and so it looked really cool to me. You killed monsters and you drew massive dungeons, and so I wanted in. And I got the famous blue box basic set that Christmas. And so back then, if you wanted to, you know, fight monsters, a tabletop role-playing game was really the only way to do it. You couldn't do it on the computer yet. So I got into it pretty heavily starting when I was in junior high.
Now, where in Illinois are you from? Because that's my old stomping grounds as well.
So Rock Island is a working man's town on the Mississippi River.
Okay.
It's the site of the first railroad bridge across the Mississippi, actually.
Oh, fantastic.
That's our claim to fame.
So you were the true gateway to the West.
Yeah, that's
doesn't
right.
hold any ground on that. That's right.
Yeah, well, there was apparently a big, there's a whole story about that bridge and how it got built and the steamboats trying to get it taken down. And yeah, it seems like a little thing now, but it was a big deal.
That's really cool. So at what point did you decide you wanted to stop just playing role-playing games and start creating them?
So when I was in college, I tried writing for role-playing games, Call of Cthulhu and RuneQuest. And I did get a few articles published, but nothing really to base a career on. And then when I had to decide what to do after college, my good friend Mark Reinhagen, he convinced me to, go into business, start publishing role-playing games. We came up with an idea for a cool role-playing game, and that's Ars Magica, the game about wizards in the Middle Ages. And I don't know, we just had a lot of chutzpah. We bought a Macintosh computer and did desktop publishing. So that was a ton of fun. And that's how I got in the field, and then through the contacts that I made there, that eventually landed me a job at Wizards, and that's how I moved out to Seattle, and I've been here ever since.
So what's been the most encouraging change that you've seen that takes place in the industry over the years?
I'm excited about the improvements in the diversity of how people are portrayed and the place of women in gaming. I think that there have been big improvements in there.
Mm-hmm.
More racial diversity in the art and that sort of thing. But for me, I think the biggest thing is that the games are just better. Like, we played sort of for fun. Someone in our gaming group got out, a classic adventure from the 80s for a role-playing game that he loved when he was in high school. And we played a couple sessions of it, but it was terrible.
Hmm.
The game system was terrible. The setting was terrible. The adventure was terrible. like you can listen to music from the 80s or whatever, if you at least listen to the right stuff, but there's precious little from early role-playing games that people would still want to play. We've just learned so much about making the games faster and more fun and, you know, less, I don't know, like there's really a sort of a cluelessness and a clumsiness to the early games that we don't put up with anymore.
The kind of initial birthing pains from wargaming into gaming.
Yeah, sort of like, you know, the idea that if it seems to simulate something well, then that's good enough, you know. And whether it's fun is not really the issue. It's really, you know, have we actually simulated the way this weapon would really work or what have you?
Yeah.
I think that led people down bad paths a lot. I mean, even great games like Call of Cthulhu, you know, that inspired me and so many people to do better role-playing games and better game design. You know, you had these horrible problems where you'd have a published adventure that would just come to a crashing halt if you did not make your spot hidden check and you never found the clue you needed. And, you know, like people won't play that way anymore.
Yeah, we've definitely moved beyond that. And actually, your comments on the inclusiveness of the RPG hobby is probably the highest praise I've been able to give to fifth edition books. Just from an art and language direction.
Yeah.
Well, let's jump to your most current game. How did 13th Age, you know, where did that come from? What was the inspiration behind it?
So 13th Age, that's a game that I did with Rob Haynes. So he's been my best friend for a long time, and we've been gaming together since 1999, I guess. And so he played in my 3rd edition game, I played in his 4th edition game, he was the lead designer on 4th. When both of us were out of Wizards, we sort of got together and thought, what's the best thing that the two of us could do together? And our answer was a game that plays sort of like D&D, but that brings in all the energy and creative freedom and excitement and whatever that we would want to put in a game we were playing for ourselves. And so the rules are streamlined and there's a lot more room for player character creativity. And that's the way we like to play. So we thought it was sort of the best game we could do, and I'm really happy with how it turned out.
Yeah, you guys did really good on that. Yeah. It kind of came out in the book, all the different call-outs, what, you know, this is what your take is on it versus this is what Rob's take is on it. Was it hard to kind of come together and figure out, okay, these sections we need to agree on, and these sections, let's just explain how we disagree on it.
Yeah. It was difficult to come to agreement on lots of things, and as the book shows, there are some things we still don't agree on. When Rob and I are at our gaming group, we sometimes get accused of bickering like an old married couple.
That's the mark of true friendship. You know that, right?
Yeah. Yeah, right? I mean, we definitely have a history. We went through a lot of different iterations. You know, we put a lot of work into it. And what you don't see in the game is all the stuff that we didn't, you know, all the systems we tried and we rejected and whatever. So, yeah, it was a real struggle to get something that both of us were really happy with and something that would, you know, not only satisfy Rob and me, but also be generally attractive enough that, you know, people who like the D&D but wanted something more would find that something more in 13th Age.
Well, and I don't know if it was intentional or not in you guys doing that, but one of the things that I picked up on as a result of you guys laying it out in that format was that this is the players and the GMs, this is their game. You know, if you don't like this rule as it's written, feel the freedom to change it. It's about the players having a good time, and it's about playing a great game, and it doesn't have to be strictly by the book. And right. Like I said, I don't know if that was intentional in the way you wrote it, but that's something that stood out to me, or I picked up on that as a result of the way you guys laid it all out.
Yeah, that is definitely intentional. So, I finally remember the rules and adventures that were written long ago, late 70s, maybe early 80s, where it was understood that this was a hobby and that the people doing the work were also fans, and it's sort of like we're sharing notes and we're, passing along advice, and this is how I do it, and here's a cool idea, and there was sort of even a sense of collaboration between the adventure writer and the rules writer and the player. And then, especially with the arrival of Advanced Dungeons and Dragons, things got locked down pretty tightly. And there was a big move to, uniformity and what have you. And also, the rules were more complete. Like if you tried to play D&D with the original rules, you did have to make stuff up because they weren't complete. And so there was this sense that, of course you don't have to go by the book. You can't possibly just go by the book. With 13th Age, we tried to do a game where you could go by the book. It is complete. So we wanted to show that Rob has his take on how to play, and I have my take, and you should have your take. I think that's what's exciting about role-playing games compared to video games, is that, it's up to the people at the table what the experience is going to be like.
Now, your game table sounds a little bit, a little bit tougher than Rob's game table. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, Rob is really concerned that the players have a good time. He's very accommodating and, he may throw stuff at us and what have you, but I'm more hard-nosed because I feel like players have a good time when they know things could have gone terribly wrong. And sometimes things have to go terribly wrong to remind them that things could go terribly wrong. And so that I'm not an adversarial game master, but I don't make things easy on the players either. And you see that, you pick that up from our rules discussions. Like I'm more willing for things to go bad for the players. That's for sure.
I knew there was a reason why I found myself nodding with your side comments and. Well, out of the rules of 13th Age, kind of two questions. What is the one aspect of 13th Age that you can point to and say, yeah, this was my baby? And then what is your favorite mechanic overall?
Yeah, so the thing that I sort of claim most ownership over is the icon concept. So in RuneQuest, which I played a lot of, your character could sign up to a religion or cult, and that would give them a place in the world. It would give them allies and enemies and maybe a philosophy or an outlook and maybe some special benefits that only a member of the fire cult can learn this special fire spell or something like that. Well, that was really powerful for helping players see their characters as part of the world, which, in Dungeons and Dragons, typically the characters are not part of the world at all. They're, wandering mercenaries who don't have families, don't have hometowns. They need to be sort of generic enough that you can drop them into any published adventure that's fine. And whereas RuneQuest said, no, your character is associated with this cult or religion. Maybe you still didn't have a family or a hometown or all the things that a regular person would have, but you did have some connection to the world. So I ported that concept back in 87. I put that into our Wizards game, where each wizard was a member of a house or lineage of wizards. And then my partner Mark picked that up for the vampire game that was so successful, and that had, of course, Vampire Clan, and that became in the sort of in the 90s, that was the big thing. New role-playing games always had factions or clans or houses or whatever for characters to be part of.
Mm-hmm.
And so the icon relationships, the way that characters are associated with one or more icons, that's sort of the equivalent, again, of me taking that old RuneQuest idea from 1979 and plugging it into a D&D style of play, where once again, you have a connection with somebody that says something about your background and who might be your allies and who might be your enemies and what resources you might have. So I say that that's the most mine, because that's something that I've been, you know, it was almost 20 years ago that I was putting that into another role-playing game, Ars Magica, and so here I am doing it again. Like, I think that's just such a strong system. My favorite piece is the Cultist. That's from 13 True Ways, and that's the class that I did. I did, like, big-picture, top-down stuff, like what the numbers are going to look like for monsters at every level or what have you. And Rob, he does more of the really particular stuff, like class design. And so he did all the classes. And in 13 True Ways, I had the opportunity to be a cultist. And so it's different from every other class out there, partly because, you know, it's the class that I did as opposed to the one that Rob did. And also because for a name like the Occultist, I wanted to do a class that's, you know, really special, really different from the other ones. And so the Occultist spends all their time sort of manipulating what's going on in the battle with the rest of the party, you know, sort of changing reality at the last minute to help or help their friends or hurt their enemies. It's a very different play style. And I like the way it turned out quite a bit.
That's I did not know that, and I'm getting to play 13th Age for the very first time. I've been running since I've got the book, and one of my players is going to step up and run an adventure here, and I just built an occultist.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
How do you like it?
I haven't got to play yet, but I was able to build a level 2 or 3 one. I really like the way the rule set works. It's gonna be an interesting change of pace.
All right, well, yeah, let me know how that turns out for you.
I'd be glad to. So we've talked about mechanics, and you know, what's your favorite mechanic to have come out of the rule set? Let's talk monsters and icons. What would be your favorite monster that you guys have statted out, and who would be your icon that you would have relationships with? Okay, that came out wrong. All right, which one of the 13 icons would you choose?
So I'm really, I guess, partial to the priestess. Back when I did the Everwing game in 95, there was a priestess card. It's sort of an iconic image. And she's also sort of reminiscent of a sort of a spiritual leader in my Over the Edge game that I did back in 92. Mm-hmm. So like this idea of someone with magical power, but also sort of a mystical outlook on life appeals to me. And, you know, I think we could have done something more like a patriarch or a hierophant, and, you know, that might have been more typical for a D&D campaign to have as a, you know, sort of the leading religious figure. But I like the priestess. I think it adds a little something extra to the mix. I think she's sort of, her mystical bent is a little different from what you would normally get from a patriarch.
Yeah.
Character. So I like her. For monsters, I like the, well, I mean, I had a lot of fun doing all the sort of standard D&D monsters over in a new way, and always trying to figure out like what's going to make them cool in a way that nobody else is cool. I like working on the lycanthropes in 13 True Ways, and you know, all the monsters, like, you know, in taking a look again at the standard, you know, here's a hill giant, here's a gargoyle, but then trying to find a way to make them interesting, I thought that was really neat. I had to pick a favorite. I'm not big on favorites, but I really like what Rob did with the River Devil in 13 True Ways. And there's even a power where characters sort of permanently lose special abilities when they fight these monsters and then have to sort of win them back by, I don't know, defeating the uber monster.
Yeah.
Like Rob's usually not that mean to players. So when he actually takes away their special abilities, I think that's fantastic. I think that's a monster people will never forget.
Right. Well, very cool. So I know the next big 13th Age project coming down the line that I've heard your name involved with is 13th Age in Glorantha.
Yep.
Which I was very glad to hear that announced at Gen Con.
And oh, good.
We've talked a little bit with Rob and Ash about it. What would you like to tell us about Glorantha and the 13th Age take on it?
So Glorantha is, you know, this amazing game world that's been around since the 70s. Like when I brought up RuneQuest, it was the world of Glorantha that featured religions that you could become part of and what have you. So that's been not only just an interesting world to read about, but it really had features that made it interesting to play in it, such as these religions you could join. So I've thought very highly of that setting for a long time and played a little bit of Glorantha using the HeroQuest rules and what have you. Rob's another big time, you know, big fan for a long time. And so it's really exciting for us to get to work on it and to work on it together. For me, the exciting thing about Glorantha is that it is a world with its own rules and reality. When we did the 13th Age setting, the Dragon Empire, we tried to be really close to what people expected. Like, we wanted to give people a dwarf king, an elf queen, and, you know, evil dragons, and the sort of stuff that they could instantly recognize so that they could start creating their own spin on things. And Glorantha is different in that it, you know, its dwarves are not like regular dwarves. Its elves are not like regular elves. And so it's really exciting to go to Glorantha and take what's cool about it and then try to present that to people, both people who are going to be new to Glorantha and sort of show them what's neat about it, but also people who are Glorantha fans. Rob and I are sort of good at figuring out how to make things fun and how to put a new spin on things. And so I think a lot of Glorantha fans are going to get our book and see, you know, see new ways to interact with and play characters in their beloved game setting. And one of the fun things about Glorantha is that everyone has their own particular perspective on the world, as influenced by what culture they're from or what religion they're from. And so it's fun to sort of get into people's heads and think about, well, here's a Humak warrior, and he worships the god of death and truth. And what does it feel like to be that kind of person in the world? And what sort of things should they be able to do? And how do they look at things, or how do people look at them? And there's all this rich material to work with, and then trying to figure out how to bring that out. That's a lot of fun. That's great work to do, is sort of showcasing and highlighting and paraphrasing and embellishing. It's great material to work with.
Is there anything about Glorantha that you're having a hard time fitting?
There's a lot of stuff a lot of small things that are difficult. You know, when I talked about how, you know, games 25 years ago were just not as good as games today, there are a lot of details in Glorantha, especially as, like, the monsters or the cults were developed in order to be RuneQuest play pieces. And they're just not up to snuff. Like, and back in 1978, it was pretty interesting just to give stats to a brew-headed monster guy, right? Like, oh, what's his strength? What's his constitution? What kind of weapon does he use? Like, if you were used to playing D&D where monsters really didn't have stats, it was really interesting to look at this monster with all its stats and think of it, oh, it's sort of like a real creature. But today, you look at that same monster and you think, well, but what's fun about fighting that monster?
Mm-hmm.
Like, so what? It's got a 35% chance to hit with a spear and a 14 constitution. That doesn't make it fun. So there are a lot of things that are part of the tradition in Galanta that just are not that, that were never created in the first place to really be engaging and interesting, but rather just to sort of to simulate what that world would be like.
Mm-hmm.
And so what we need to do is go, okay, well, we've got these goat-headed brew monsters, and we need something really interesting about them for, you know, some way in which fighting them feels different from fighting any other monster. And it's a challenge. And in some ways, you know, there are things that are that can make it difficult to play around the table.
Mm-hmm.
So, like one example is the healers from Galanta had spells that they could use to subdue enemies, but then once an enemy was subdued, nobody was supposed to kill that enemy because the healer had subdued it, and the healer is honor-bound not to kill people or what have you. Well, that seems kind of interesting, but in play, in RuneQuest, it was sort of difficult, actually, because, you know, if you have a bunch of players where the different characters have different motivations or different things they can and cannot do, it makes it harder for them to cooperate. And so there are a lot of things like that that were fine in 1980, but today we expect the game to be designed to make play more interesting and easier. It's a little harder to do. Lots of little stuff. How do we make this monster interesting? How do we, you know, how do we have make this effect work in such a way that, you know, good for the game?
Although that healer example, yeah, I agree that trying to stat that out and making that a mechanic might disrupt things or make things unbalanced. I was just sitting here thinking, that would be a really intriguing one unique thing, though, if your character cannot kill anything else.
Yeah.
So either you hit the final blow and it just knocks him out, or he has one hit point left and he'll always have one hit point left regardless of how many times. I don't know.
That is interesting. And you personally not being able to kill something, that seems fine. But if it's just I prevent the other players from doing what they want to do, that's where, you know, that's where it's just like that causes problems at the table. That causes problems in real life between the players playing.
Absolutely.
And that doesn't seem worth it.
Well, I'm looking forward to it. I've been a huge Galanta fan for a very long time, and am hoping that this will be a gateway drug for my game group.
Yeah.
maybe even as far as along the road getting them to step away from the D20 mechanic into RuneQuest. But even if I can just play Galanta with 13th Age, I'm very excited about that, or the fact that I will be able to.
Yeah. Well, I hope you will like it. It's really interesting. It's really interesting work.
All right. So I've got to ask you, when we talked to Rob about the 13th Age in Galanta, we got a little bit of hesitancy about him including ducks. And I'm just curious, what's your opinion on ducks in 13th Age?
I brought that up to Rob, and he immediately groaned. And
so they're sort of like a dividing point. Like, so ducks are they're either humans who have been cursed with duck shape, or they're ducks that have been cursed with human-like hands and the inability to fly or whatever. So they're sort of like Howard the Duck. They're kind of, or Donald Duck. They seem a little goofy, but on the other hand, they are often initiates of death cults, and they are sworn enemies of the undead, and so they have a little bit of sort of badassness about them. That's one of the things that's interesting about Galanta when they say it has its own logic. Like, you know, in the real world, there are bizarre things that don't make a lot of sense, and in Galanta, there are these ducks.
Yeah.
For me, I think the way to play them is that they carry with them almost an aura of menace. That it's established that they are cursed somehow, one way or another. Their whole race of them is cursed, and that's why they're ducks. and also that they are, you know, death cult fighters of undead. And so maybe if you juxtapose the, well, they're small, they look sort of funny, but whenever one of them walks into the room, people get the chills and, you know, become aware of their own mortality. Maybe by playing with the sort of their aura or reputation in that way, people can take them seriously instead of them just being sort of goofy.
Yeah, everyone will laugh at a duck, but never to its face.
Yeah.
Well, Jonathan, thank you so much for coming on. Nick, do you have any final questions? Or
just one last question, Jonathan. What is your one unique thing?
Wow. What is my one unique thing? I think it figures out how to explain things better.
Excellent.
So for example, the when Rob and I would talk about, in the rule book, we talk about our different attitudes towards things. Like that format for how to explain things and how to make things clear to people is, I think that's an example of finding a new way to approach the same material. And I did that with like beginner games, I did beginner versions of Magic and of Dungeons and Dragons when I was at Wizards, and I was on the beginner game council there working on all our beginner products. And then my latest claim to fame is the Grandmother Fish book, which is the first book to teach evolution to preschoolers. So that's me figuring out how to take this complicated idea of common descent and evolution and put it in terms that a little kid can, understand and be engaged with. And that, even if you go back to my earlier games, like Ars Magica, there was a lot of material in there about how to explain the, not just the rules, but the feel of the game. We did an introductory adventure called the Stormrider, and that, laid things out bit by bit. It assumed that the game master had never run a game before and sort of took them by the hand and explained to them, this is how you do a perception check, and this is how you use the combat up.
I might still have
over
that
the
adventure.
Edge of the game that I did that's very freeform and really just sort of cut to the chase of, you're going to have this character, and you're going to make up any kind of character you want, and here's all you need to know, a couple of simple things to build that character up. So sort of explaining or repackaging or paraphrasing or finding a new way to approach an old topic, that's my one unique thing.
That's really cool. Very cool. Well, for those of you in the Denver area who are heading to Starfest, you can come meet Jonathan Tweet at Starfest 2015. He is the guest of honor in the Game Fest portion.
That sounds great.
Yeah. Well, Jonathan, thank you so much. This was a lot of fun. Sorry it took us so long to get you on.
Yeah, it's been great.
Well, we are pleased to announce our second contest for the Iconic podcast. We're calling it Get Out and Run 13th Age.
How original.
After doing our organized play episode, Mark, Nick, and I were chatting, and we wanted to do something to get organized play up and running at your local game store, and what better way to do that than with our listeners. Nick, why don't you tell us about the contest?
All right. What we are wanting you to do is to go to your friendly local gaming store and run one of the organized play adventures, and then tell us about it. We will need to know your name, the name of your gaming store, when you ran it, what adventure, and what parts of that adventure, and then a maximum of 300-word write-up of what happened. And it would be great also if we could get a picture of your group so we can see what your table looks like.
We'll post all of the entries on the website. Winners will be determined randomly, but each session that you run will count as a separate entry. I mean, you'll have to put a separate entry together, but you can enter multiple times, but you can only win once. And what kind of contest would it be without prizes? Mark, tell us about our prizes.
Okay, we were graciously allowed to offer the first place winner $20 used on Pelgrane's Press website. Second gets 15, and third gets 10. Remember, you can only win once, but the more you enter, the greater chance to win that first prize.
That's right. So when you're ready to submit your entry, jump over to iconicpodcast.com. There will be a post that has a link to a Google form that will just allow you to fill out all of that and submit it. In fact, that is the official way to submit entries for this contest. All other ways will be looked at and then promptly discarded. This contest will run between now and March 31st. We're giving you just over 2 full months to get into your game store, get a group going. Winners will be announced by April 6th. Get out there and game. Well, you've been listening to the Iconic Podcast.
If you have any questions or comments, you can contact us at whitedragon@iconicpodcast.com or call and leave a voicemail at 720-924-1706.
And check out iconicpodcast.com for news, updates, and new episodes.
Thanks for listening.